So Thursday, I start getting a little bit of a toothache, and I think it's just some minor irritation. Friday, it flares off and on a little bit, and then at about 5 o'clock, I think I should see a dentist, but it's Friday at 5 o'clock. So yesterday, it gets pretty bad. So this morning, if I start crying during the sermon, it's not because the material is moving. It's because I have a toothache. So just give you a heads up. All right, we continue today with part 4 of our short series on the Song of Solomon. We are on track to finish this up next Sunday. You might say that this series has two major units to it. Unit 1, and I've talked about this before, deals with helpful things to know when we read the Song of Solomon. And this part is very important. In fact, that's why we're spending 4 weeks on it. Unit 2, which starts next week, will be the engaging in the text itself, working through the book. As mentioned in previous weeks, we won't do this verse by verse, but rather more like section by section. And Unit 2 will be relatively short. It starts next week and will finish next week. I'm not planning to focus on too many of the details of this book unless it becomes relevant for some reason. Now, I am kind of actually entertaining the possibility of taking a Sunday off a little bit here in September to address any questions that anyone might have about the book itself or anything that was said in the series. So if you have something, you could pass it on to me. You could drop it in my folder. You could put it in the wall pocket. You could email it to me. You could slip it under my office door. It can be anonymous, whatever you'd like to do. And if I get several of these, then I'll kind of plan on that, either take a whole Sunday or maybe just part of one. Now, as in previous weeks, I won't take time today to do much in the way of review, but to help set things up for this morning, I'll at least mention what we've covered so far. The first Sunday, of course, was an introduction, and I shared a number of challenges that the average reader will face with the Song of Solomon. And Tina wasn't here for that Sunday. She's not here with us today. But last week, she did tell me that she took the assignment and she read the book and she didn't understand anything in it. So, Tina, if you were here, maybe you're watching online, welcome to the club. You're not alone. I kept referring to the kaleidoscope image that I have here behind me as a good way to describe the impression one has when reading it. It is beautiful, it is colorful, but it's also chaotic and confusing. And in fact, Ted and I were talking a little bit this morning about how God, of course, would not have been surprised by this effect that it has on us, and thus the motivation to dig and to work it and to research it and to look into it and to spend time really wrestling with it. And it's sort of like the same way that we do with parables, and I think that there's something to be said about that. All right. And weeks 2 and 3, we got into the business of the book itself, working through a number of questions. What is Solomon's relationship to this book? And when was it written? And what is going on in it? What's the activity? And what's the story of the book? And are these two lovers married? And why is some of the content explicit? And how are we to decipher the strange comparisons? And then last week, we covered these three questions. How is one to manage the difficult poetry? And how do we know that the Song of Solomon wasn't meant to be an allegory? And since it isn't an allegory, then where do we find Jesus in the Song of Solomon? So again, if you missed any of these, let me just encourage you to listen to them on their website because they'll be especially helpful in preparation for next Sunday. Today, we will continue with that list of questions, and I will finish this out. I have 5 more to go. The next one, number 11, is actually related to number 9. Have there been any other methods of interpreting the Song of Solomon besides the allegorical and natural or literal? Well, actually, there have been quite a few through the centuries, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because the chances are not that high that you will run into them. Most of them have never really gained much traction, but it may be just kind of helpful here as an exercise to get some idea of the variety of ways that the Song of Solomon has been approached. Along with the allegorical and literal, there was another one called the drama interpretation, which suggests that the Song of Solomon was written as a play that was to be enacted on a stage. And the problem here, of course, is that the drama needs a storyline. And as we have noted, there isn't one in this book. If there is one, it escapes us. We do not find a plot or a sequential series of events leading up to some grand climactic ending. There is also the historical interpretation that claims this book describes an actual romantic affair from the life of Solomon. We addressed this a couple weeks ago when dealing with the question of Solomon's relationship to this book. But in addition to this, we should also note that there's nothing in the book that implies that some historical event is actually being preserved. Other historical books in the Bible, as you know, they give us names and locations, and we'll place the events in some kind of a timeline and so forth. And we don't have any of that here. And then there is the cultic interpretation that the Song of Solomon is actually erotic literature that originated from one of the fertility cults associated with the Babylonians and other pagan religions of long ago. But the Song of Solomon lacks many of the crucial features found in such literature, like an emphasis on fertility, for instance. And in such literature, sexual activity is described graphically, erotically, and serves as a ritual for idol worship. But in the Song of Solomon, love or sex has no ritual power, and any success experienced in lovemaking, it is not attributed to any deity. But even apart from that, it is difficult to see how the Song of Solomon would have been admitted into the canon if it were anything along those lines. And then there is the funeral interpretation, which I find to be quite bizarre, but apparently there is some indication that funerals in the ancient Near East were love feasts celebrated with wine, women, and song, and that this was the original setting for the Song of Solomon. The theory for this is largely based on a verse in chapter 8 where we are told that love is as strong as death. You guys have been reading it, right? Love is as strong as death. And but that simply is, you know, as we know, a figure of speech representing the inescapable power of love. Like death, it will never release those it has taken hold of. And then there is, as we would expect, a wedding interpretation that the Song of Solomon is the text used in a wedding ceremony. In this, the bride and groom perform various dances and praise each other with the songs in the book. It is, of course, possible that parts of the Song of Solomon were used in ancient weddings, but it is a stretch to suggest that it was intended to be a textbook or a script for such ceremonies. There's no record or tradition to support this, and the narrative of the book itself, it doesn't really lend itself to that either. So as far as I can tell, all reputable scholars today, Bible-believing and theologically conservative, argue that the Song of Solomon should be interpreted in its most natural and literal sense, that it is what it appears to be, love poetry, or more specifically, a love song. And this is, in fact, the earliest of the interpretations, and it is the one that is self-evident. And as Denny has taught us, if the plain sense makes good sense, then look for no other sense. And we should also note that the Song of Solomon has a number of parallels to ancient Egyptian love poetry, and these similarities further the case. Now, actually, the book is a song that consists of several songs. And as we noted in previous weeks, there are at least four different parties taking turns singing, but they do not follow a particular order, and some songs are short and others longer. And this then leads us to the next question, number 12, and we'll be spending some time here. How is the Song of Solomon structured? As with many books in the Bible, if we can figure out its outline, it will help us to identify, it will help us to follow the train of thought, identify what that train of thought is, and recognize the intended main points. I now have 9 commentaries on this book, along with a number of study Bibles and other resources that I refer to. And on this, they all propose different theories on how the book is structured. And at the same time, they all will admittedly agree that the question of structure is a difficult one. And here are some of the reasons for that. With, you know, what you have here with all the various singing parts and repeating phrases and imagery and so on, it would seem that it would have a structure. And so everyone wants to give it a shot. Surely there's something here. But while there is in the poetry a kind of narrative, there is, as we talked about, no central plot to work off of. And there is no climactic grand ending that everything is leading up to. And sometimes it's difficult to know who the speaker is, or rather who the singer is. And transitions from one section to the next tend to be abrupt and choppy, and there's no smooth flow from one to the next. And furthermore, it's sometimes unclear whether a theme is continuing or whether something altogether new is happening. And sections that appear to be story-like are difficult to make sense out of, and it is unclear how they relate to other story-like sections or whether they are intended to be related at all, and so on. All this and more makes it hard to determine its structure, even if it has one. Now, I'm not going to take time today to survey all the different outlines and arrangements that have been proposed, but there is one that is somewhat appealing, even novel, that might help at least illustrate some of the work and creativity that has been invested in the effort. It views the physical consummation of the young man and his bride as the central point of the book, and then attempts to show that everything else serves to highlight that. And this theory builds off the traditional understanding that the last verse of chapter 4 and the first verse of chapter 5 is figurative language that references that marital act. And if you were to look at those two verses, where they are placed in the book, you will see that it's right in the middle, right in the center. And if you were to look at the verses before this, and the verses that follow, you could actually see some similarities. And all of this suggests that there could be some kind of what we call chiasm going on. Here is a diagram of a chiasm. We've talked about these before. We sometimes refer to them as inverted parallelisms. Take, for instance, a poem that would have maybe 9 verses. If it were a chiasm, the first and last verses would be related in some way, as would verses 2 and 8 and 3 and 7 and so on. And the middle verse, verse 5 in this particular example, would be the central point. Literally, it is found in the center of the poem, and its point would be the one that all the others would serve to highlight. And we find chiasms all through the Bible, especially in the Psalms. Some have noted or have observed that that a chiasm resembles menorahs, the lampstand in the temple, which is kind of interesting. And while we're at it, sometimes the center will consist of 2 lines that are parallel instead of one that stands on its own. And just to be expected, efforts have taken to see if there is a chiastic structure in the Song of Solomon. So let's look at this. Follow along as we work from the outside toward the middle. We have at the beginning of the book an expression, "Take me away," and at the very end, "Come away." And then as we go to 1:4, we have the daughters of Jerusalem singing. And in 8:13, we have the daughters of Jerusalem being mentioned. And then in 1:5-7, the young woman refers to 2 vineyards, one that belongs to her brothers and one that belongs to her. And then in 8:10-12, we have the young woman refers to 2 vineyards. I'm missing it. I'm sorry. I'm ruining the whole effect here. All right. And then in 8:10-12, the young woman refers to 2 vineyards again, one that belongs to Solomon and one that belongs to her, and she prefers her own. All right, now let's follow along. And then we have the young man and the young woman in 1:8-14. They make various references to breasts, silver, and he says, "We will make," in this case, earrings. And then in 8:9-9, we have brothers of the young woman referring to brass, silver, and "We will build," in that case, towers. And 1:15-2:2, the young woman refers to the beauty of her house. And in 8:6-7, the young woman refers to the wealth of a man's house. And all through the book here, we're not going to look at all of them, there are these words, ideas, images that appear to match. And they continue to collapse to a single point there at the middle. And there are at least 18 lines to this chiasm. And we'll pick it up. We'll skip ahead, pick it up at 4:8-15, where the young man speaks of myrrh, spice, and honey. And this is paired with the last part of 5:1, where the young man speaks again of myrrh, spice, and honey. And finally, the heart of the matter, what everything was leading toward. In the last verse of chapter 4, the woman now invites the man to enjoy her garden. And the next verse, first part of verse 1 in chapter 5, the man in his song speaks of entering the garden and enjoying its pleasures. And this, then, it is argued, is the central point of the book, what everything is either heading toward, leading forward to, or emphasizing, or in some way contributing to. So what do you think? As interesting and appealing as this scheme may appear to be, I found a couple problems with it. And far be for me to doubt those who are smarter than me, but I just didn't find this whole thing to be all that convincing. First, I took the chart that had been mapped out and tried to connect these parallel lines and tried to do that in different translations, and I just found it to be a stretch. If the Song of Solomon is a giant chiasm, it is far from being obvious. Some of the lines do connect, but others tend to be forced. The other thing that I'm not convinced of, and more to the heart of the matter, is this assumption that the marital act referenced in those two verses at the end of chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5, that this serves as the central point of the book. And in fact, a lot of other outlines that people try to come up with are built on that same assumption. And I want to talk about this, not because it affects our attempts to structure the Song of Solomon, but it also has a bearing on how much significance we place in this book on the physical consummation of the couple. And that is admittedly a tricky thing, but it's an important thing for us to wrestle with. So here are my thoughts on this. Because of the figurative language that is used, it is a bit uncertain whether those two verses actually refer to the marital act. And it certainly could, but we don't know for sure. Along that line, there are a number of other places in the book that appear to be referring to the marital act as well. And they seem to be actually more explicit. And there actually could be several of these. And two, which are found as early as the first chapter, and another in chapter 3. And each of these are way, way before we get to 4:16 and 5:1. And a couple of these, are far less obscure. They leave no question. Just a few verses into the book. I mean, the book practically opens this way. The young woman sings, "The king has brought me into his bedroom." To me, that doesn't sound like everything is leading up to that later on. It's happening right here at the beginning. The book begins with two lovers already in his bedroom. And then in chapter 3, they are yet in another bedroom. Not his, but her mother's, which is kind of strange, but that's what it is. And in fact, the verse actually says, "I brought him into my mother's bed." And it is clear what she has in mind for that. She says that this was where she was conceived, the place where her mother had intimate relations, and now it is her turn. The point is, the episode described in those two verses, 4:16 and 5:1, may not be the central point after all. It may simply be one of many episodes. And if so, we should probably not try to force outlines of the book around it. And for that matter, is it really the book's intention to focus on the marital act itself? And a lot of people approach the book as though, yeah, that's a given. That's what it's all about. But I would be of the school of thought that would say, well, maybe not. Probably not. Most of the lovemaking in this book is verbal, not physical. It is a young man telling his bride how beautiful she is, how much he admires her, how much she means to him, and he can't stand it when he is not with her. And the young woman tells him the same sorts of things. Whatever hot romance is going on in this book, it is mostly words of affection and very little about sex. And so again, efforts to outline the book with sex as the centerpiece are, at least to me, dubious at best. Now, other commentators take a more linear approach, dividing the Song of Solomon into sequential sections. One has come up with five main points, another five main parts, another six parts, another seven, another eight, and so on. And yet another divides the book into all the different songs, 23 of them. And so this becomes an outline of 23 parts. And so, again, this is a difficult book to outline. And there are repeating themes and ideas and a kind of cycle. You probably have seen that as you've read it. But there doesn't appear to be any symmetrical or clear structure that can be precisely defined. In fact, interestingly, the apparent lack of direction has caused some scholars to conclude that instead of being a whole song, a unity, that the Song of Song is actually a mishmash of several different songs that have been compiled together, kind of like a loose collection. But This theory has failed to gain much momentum due to the fact that there are indeed noticeable indications of unity in the song, and you've picked up on these. There are common themes, words, expressions, ideas, phrases, images that are repeated, and the style itself is consistent from beginning to end. It is the work of one composer, not many. So perhaps our best approach is not to worry too much about how the book is arranged, but to simply follow it as a series of love songs between a young man and a young woman who are newly married. There is no central plot that everything points toward, no grand ending either. Rather, the song is one that seems to simply describe the ebb and flow of the relationship between two people who are hopelessly lovesick. All right, number 13, next question, which sounds quite boring and technical, but it isn't too much. What literary forms does the Song of Solomon share with other ancient love poetry? So we'll just spend a couple minutes on this, but I actually found this rather interesting. We have the admiration song, and in this, the lover sings of the wonderful qualities of his or her beloved, and often the physical beauty is described, but sometimes moral virtues are praised, and Song of Solomon has quite a few of these. Some of them are rather lengthy. And with this one and the others here, I'm not going to take time to look at the examples. Hopefully, as you've been reading the Song of Solomon, you've become familiar with it, that you'll be able to recognize these at this point. We have also Songs of Yearning. In this, the man or woman sings of his or her desire for the beloved, and such songs about talk about efforts to get to the beloved, and there's obstacles and expressions of lovesickness and worries and so on. Then you have the arrival song. This is a short song that celebrates the coming of the beloved. And then the invitation. In this song, the lover invites the beloved to come away with him or her. Sometimes it merely refers to something like, let's leave what we're doing and spend some time together. And sometimes the invitation is for something more. Next question, which is similar. What literary motifs does the Song of Solomon share with other ancient love poetry? So you kind of have to love the word motifs. This is a word that you would expect to hear in everyday conversation with Nate Elkington, but most of us don't use the word a lot. A motif is a reoccurring subject, theme, or idea. In poetry, this would include recurring images and symbols and figures of speech. Again, just a couple minutes on this one. A partial list would include lovesickness. This generally occurs in a song of yearning. In it, the lover claims that he or she is so filled with longing for the beloved that it has made him or her ill. And then you have the door. This is common, not just in the Song of Solomon, but in other ancient poetry. The image of the door represents both obstacle and opening. When it's an obstacle, there is, of course, frustration. Either the door won't open, or when it is open, the beloved is found to be angry, or in the case of Song of Solomon, absent. An open door, on the other hand, represents invitation, opportunity. That which is yearned for is now present and accessible. You have the gazelle or stag. A male lover is often called a leaping gazelle or stag by the woman. Typically, this represents his swiftness, his speed. He rapidly pursues her because of his passionate desire. And the gazelle was also in ancient culture a symbol of masculine sexuality. And then horses and chariots. In ancient love poetry, the man is also portrayed as having an entourage of horses and chariots and armies, that sorts of thing. And this is common in arrival songs. The imagery prompts feelings of valor and manly splendor. And then you have the garden or vineyard. The delights of a garden with sweet fragrances and fresh fruit are very common in love poetry. They represent pleasure, indulgence, fulfillment. What comes to mind are the delights of touch, taste, and aroma. Sometimes the garden can be a metaphor for either the woman's body or for love making. Other motifs include the kiss, the breasts, authority figures like parents or city guardians, and a heart that has been stolen by the lover. If you've been reading the Song of Solomon, again, all those should sound somewhat familiar. So, the Song of Solomon shares some similarities with other love poetry of the ancient world, like these and other motifs, but unlike other ancient poetry, the Song of Solomon is not graphically erotic in the use of them. All right, next question, which is actually the last one, moving through this again, rather like just moving through it rather quickly here. Maybe I'm speaking too fast. Am I talking too fast? All right. I always feel like I'm talking too fast. Theology and application. I'll just lump those two together. Basically, what are the takeaways from this book? What are its lessons? How does a Song of Solomon contribute to our understanding of anything or to our daily practice? Well, obviously a comprehensive answer to this could occupy 4 to 5 weeks itself, but a few points are worth mentioning, and some I don't need to say a lot about because they've already have already been elaborated on in previous weeks. So I just have four of these to close out Unit 1 with for today. The first one is this. A good case can be made that the primary audience intended for the Song of Solomon is not married couples. And that's kind of the traditional thinking, that it's for married couples, or that it's for newlyweds. In your reading of this book these past weeks, do you recall any specific exhortations or advice? Does anything come to mind? And if so, do you recall to whom were these exhortations given? Anything come to mind? Does this sound familiar? O daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or waken love until it so desires. In other words, as some translations have it, until the time is right. Remember that phrase? And in 3:5, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or waken love until it so desires. And a third time in 8:4, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, do not arouse or waken love until it so desires. Well, these are the only exhortations I could find, at least the ones that are explicitly stated. And they each give the same instruction, the same advice. And so if there is an intended audience, it would appear that it would be those who are unmarried, in particular, single young women. The daughters of Jerusalem are admonished to wait for sexual intimacy. Their desires are saying yes. Their instincts are saying yes. Their bodies are saying yes. Their suitors might even be saying yes, or at least please. But the message of wisdom is to wait, to guard their virginity. Not forever, but certainly for now. Wait for marriage. Here in the Song of Solomon, this counsel does not come through the voice of a father or a mother, or from a celibate prophet, or from a religious leader, or any authoritative figure, but from a peer, a friend, someone who was just days earlier one of the daughters of Jerusalem herself, one of the girls. As you read the Song of Solomon, you see these occasions where the bride seems to come out of her wedding chamber, love scene after love scene, to tell her friends, wait for this. What I am enjoying, wait for it. It will be worth it. Cool your passions now and arouse them later when it is time. Patience, then passion. This is, to me, obviously the exhortation, the lesson. Wait until you can give your love without reservation, without guilt, to the one who will pledge himself to you. Strange as it may sound, this is a book parents should give to their teenage daughters. That seems to be who the Song of Solomon is meant for. And note again the approach. It is not fornication is sin and God will bear down on you with his judgment, though certainly the Bible does teach that. But here it is in these pages, why yield to something so cheap and meaningless and be riddled with guilt, regret, and shame when with patience you can enjoy it in all of its richness and fullness? In other words, why a mud pie in the slum when you can have a holiday on the sea, to borrow from C.S. Lewis? Patience, then passion. In chapter 8, the young woman makes it clear that she is in control of her vineyard, that it belongs to her, and she is the one who will decide who to give it to and when. What a powerful statement. It's just tucked away there in a verse in chapter 8, something you can just easily read through and not even catch. But what a powerful statement. I am in control of my vineyard. I will give it to who I want to, when I want to. It is mine. What a powerful point to counter today's thinking. You can say no. You can say no to your desires. You can say no to the culture that pressures you. You can say no to your boyfriend. Do not surrender that which is of great value, because once it is surrendered, you cannot get it back. Give it to only the one who will pledge to you his fidelity, faithfulness, and steadfast commitment. Give your virginity only to the one you will be joined with exclusively and permanently, to the one who will set you as a seal over his heart. So, give the Song of Solomon to your daughter. And while we're at it, just to take a kind of a moment here and a sidebar, give your teenage son the book of Proverbs. If the Song of Solomon is a book for girls, the Proverbs is a book for boys. In regards to sexuality, both complement each other quite well. The words son is used in the Proverbs over 40 times, but we never find the word daughter ever used. Throughout the book, we find this recurring advice: stay away from that kind of girl. Don't marry a woman like that one. Be careful of the traps of those who are attractive and appealing but are yet promiscuous. Don't be seduced. Stay away from them. Show self-restraint. Be careful who you date. Here, marry a woman like this one. Chapter 31. And that's how the book ends. It seems to be intentionally. Proverbs even advise guys to stay away from women who complain and nag. As a wife, she'll drive you crazy. You'll long to live up in the corner of the attic just to avoid her. I mean, all sorts of advice. As you know, Proverbs is heavy on warnings to young men, especially in regards to lust and the pitfalls of sexual sin. So again, in regards to sexuality, Proverbs and Song of Solomon complement each other. Each one goes about it a little bit differently. The Song of Solomon seems to have girls in mind and gives them clear and divine wisdom. Patience, patience, then passion. A second takeaway from the Song of Solomon is the value of beauty. A lot could be said about this, but beauty is everywhere in this book. We find it in the pictures of nature. We find it in the attractiveness the lovers find in each other, that this is a good and wholesome thing. And even in the poetry itself, as difficult as it may be, it's beautiful to read. The Song of Solomon affirms beauty, and as Scripture, this affirmation recognizes it as a gift from God. Another one of his many blessings he intended to bless us with. And number three, you've heard this several times now, but it bears repeating, especially here under this heading of theology and application. In the Song of Solomon, sexuality is seen as a good thing protected by marriage and not as an evil thing made permissible by marriage. The marriage bed is holy, not defiled. It is pure, not sinful. It is something God has called good. It is not something inherently dirty and corrupt that God reluctantly allows for. Not at all. It is not a necessary evil for the purpose of procreation. So again, the Song of Solomon, the Song of Solomon can be read as an extended commentary on the very good spoken over creation, especially over the creation of mankind as male and female. In fact, when you read this book, images of Eden may have come to mind. The purity of the garden with its freshness and sweet fragrances, a paradise of trees and nature. There is somewhat of the sense in the Song of Solomon that it is an undoing of the estrangement between man and woman after the fall, spoken of in Genesis. You know, the words, "I belong to my lover and his desire is for me," makes quite a striking contrast to that verse in Genesis, "Your desire will be for your husband." And here, in this book, Adam and Eve, man and woman, can stand before each other naked and not be ashamed. Regardless, the song presents a view of male-female sexuality, which is good, pure, is to be desired, sought after, and enjoyed, a good thing protected by marriage, a good thing that is to be honored by all. And finally, number four under this point, similar to number three, another takeaway from the Song of Solomon is that God intended marriage to have passion. Couples are to delight in each other, pursue each other, long for each other, compliment and praise each other. The lovers here in these pages literally excite each other. And whenever separated, they can't wait to be reunited. It is this passion that drives their songs of love far more than the sexuality. Again, most of the romance and lovemaking in the Song of Solomon is verbal, communicating appreciation and affection for each other. And so, husbands need to speak often and openly of their love for and joy in their wives. And likewise, wives need to speak often and openly of their love for and joy in their husbands. In the Song of Solomon, each take the initiative. There are settings where the man goes first and settings where the woman goes first, but each take the initiative. All right, next week we will work through the text, again, not verse by verse. And as mentioned last week, this will be fast and light. The picture, again, comes to mind like a swift and young gazelle leaping over the mountains and bounding over the hills. So we're not going to get lost in the details. But if you have questions about anything in the book that's not covered by the end of last week, then feel free to submit those to me. And I would just ask you again, if you could please try to read the Song of Solomon so it's fresh in mind Saturday night, because I don't want to take time to read through it on Sunday morning. So if you could do that, that'd be very helpful. So at this point, I think Dave is going to come and close our service.